Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Pick the one thing this economy needs to get better. Nah, it's not a housing recovery. It's not more corporate profits. Try this. A simple day's work. Jobs. Today and all week on the program from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Tuesday today, the 6th of September. Good to have you with us. And here we are, post-Labor Day, the time of year when news traditionally picks back up after taking the month of August off. We have had, as you know, no such breather this year, and even a brief perusal of recent headlines shows we're in for more of the same. The European debt crisis lingers. This morning, Switzerland, of all places, said it's going to intervene hard in the foreign exchange markets. And to top it all off, now the post office is talking about shutting down. One hesitates to ask what could possibly happen next. What's going to happen this week on the broadcast, though, is more of our coverage of the breakdown, our economy one step at a time, specifically jobs. There was the dismal August unemployment report Friday. GOP candidates are coming out with their jobs plans. There's the president's speech Thursday night on the topic. Everybody says they want more jobs. So as we start a week of unpacking the American labor market, we figured we ought to define our terms a little bit. First of all, who's not working? Here's Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman.
Among the 14 million Americans who the government counts as unemployed is Richard Andreessen. He's 64. He's been a teacher, a salesman, a sailor, and he hasn't worked for 2 years. I met him at the unemployment office in Portland, Oregon.
I called an airline in California. They have an announcement at two different sites, and I used to work for the airlines, so I think it would be a good fit.
He's officially unemployed because he tried to find a job in the last month. Now meet Stephanie Terrio of Gloucester, Mass. She was a mortgage underwriter until she got laid off in 2006. She was looking for a job.
Until I got depressed, because it's like they're not hiring me. The longer it went, they wouldn't hire you.
She's not actively looking, so she's not counted among the 9.1% of working-age adults who are officially unemployed. Tom Nardone is with the Bureau of Labor Statistics.
You do have people who have stopped looking. We have seen an increase in that group of people who are marginally attached to the labor force.
Marginally attached. That's people who can work and want to work, but for some reason have stopped trying to work. But that's still not everyone who's looking for work. Nardone says you also have to add
people who are working part-time, so they are employed, but who would prefer to have full-time work.
Pushing the total unemployment rate right now to more than 16%. And that's in spite of the fact that there are actually fewer Americans in the workforce than before the recession. 300,000 fewer, according to Heidi Shierholz of the Economic Policy Institute. She reckons there should have been millions more joining the workforce, teenagers and 20-somethings graduating school, 30-somethings returning to work after child raising.
And we don't have a ton of good information on what happens to people who maybe in better times would have been in the labor market with a job or at least looking for work.
Economist Gary Bertless at the Brookings Institution has some ideas.
We have a lot of people whose careers are being delayed. They aren't starting. People whose careers are ending years earlier than they wanted them to. It's hard to hold out a lot of hope for these people given the anemic pace at which employers are adding to their payrolls.
When the economy finally does start to show signs of life again, some of those people will jump back into the job search, which could actually drive the unemployment rate higher. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Hi, my name is Bernard Vincent, and I've been out of work for a year and a half. I used to work in a mail room. I used to supervise a mail room. So I'm just taking whatever I could get now.
My name's Carla Torgrimson. I was a real estate leasing agent, but the new company that bought out my old company changed the title to leasing consultant. The job just ended 2 weeks ago.
I'm David Sears, and I'm 28 years old. I was at a production company, Jordan Home Brands, making artificial fire logs, and got laid off from there on the 8th of last month.
John Butler. I'm 39, and for 4.5 years I worked for the CVS Corporation. I was a manager there December of 2010, so it's been about, 9 or 10 months now.
My name is Gajara Parkman, and I'm 30 years old. My last job, I worked at LabCorp through Brookwood Hospital. I've been out of work for, 2 years and a week.
Voices that came from Birmingham, Alabama, New York City, and Washington, D.C. as the Labor Day weekend wrapped up. Marketplace's Sarah Gardner spent some time today digging into the details of what kinds of jobs we are actually losing.
January 2008.
Happy days are here again.
We didn't realize it then, but that was the peak, at least peak employment, nearly 138 million jobs. Since then, we've dropped about 6.9 million jobs, and the big losers probably won't surprise you, says data cruncher Rob Sense at Economic Modeling Specialists.
Biggest losses have come first in construction.
2.6 million to be exact.
Followed by manufacturing.
2.3 million.
I mean, just those two, that's enormous.
Many of those middle-class jobs, says Sense. Add to that lesser losses in retail jobs like store clerks, administrative jobs like office managers, and the people who sell wholesale, like the guys who supply lumber to those construction guys, you've got your five biggest losers. Economist Greg Dako at IHS Global Insight says city and state government workers aren't far behind and gaining fast.
And those are also jobs that earned a very decent income.
Any good news?
Just looking at the data this way, we don't really see much positive. I'm trying to think of something.
Actually, there are a few bright spots. Home health aides are in demand. So are roustabouts in the oil and gas industry. Those are the guys, and yes, most of them are guys, who clean and repair the equipment on oil and gas rigs. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
There was a slight European hangover on Wall Street today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. So when we talk about jobs, what are we really saying anyway? Because the language that people use makes a difference. Consider a job-killing policy versus plans for job creation. So we've called a writer, somebody who uses specific words to impart specific meanings, to maybe get a little bit of insight. James Reed used to teach creative writing at the University of Nebraska, Omaha. He was also the managing editor of the Nebraska Review. Mr. Reed, good to have you with us.
Thanks for so much for having me on.
When you, as a writer, use words like jobs or work, what do you mean?
Well, work is that huge chunk of almost everybody's day, assuming they're employed, that takes up an enormous amount of your time and creates a lot of interesting relationships with the people you work with, and it determines a lot of how the rest of your life works. But it's that huge block that is absolutely fundamental to the way so many of us live.
Well, and it's funny, actually, because there are far more works of fiction out there about love and romance and relationships, failed or otherwise, and family than there are about work, about the job.
Well, I found that out, oddly enough. I was asked by a business department at a college here to teach a class for creative writing for business majors. And they wanted a lot of work-related fiction to be the reading list. And I discovered that there wasn't much, that most stories about work weren't really about work at all. And so I had to really dig around to come up with a bunch.
You are a writer, but like many, you have to hold down a day job to do your writing, don't you?
I have a part-time job in the printing industry, and I've had some version of that for years and years and years. I'm lucky my wife is a saint. She's a teacher and is willing to help support this.
Yeah, we're calling you, obviously, because we're concentrating on jobs this week. The president's giving a big speech. We had the labor number on Friday, no new jobs in the economy. I'm hoping you can give some clarity as to how we can disengage from the extremely sensitized way that the word jobs is used in this economy. And can we do that?
I think one thing that happens in the kind of abstract numbers game is the people who are working with those aren't really seeing the kind of day-to-day problems that people have if they are having difficulty with jobs. There are people who can't get jobs. There are people whose hours have been reduced enormously. There are people whose wages are pretty stagnant. And that's something that I think fiction or literature, the arts generally, does better than anything. It tells you what it feels like to have these things going on in people's lives.
It strikes me that it's a bunch of white-collar politicians talking about what is oftentimes blue-collar life.
Yeah, depressions and recessions tend to be felt in the blue-collar world first. And I've spent a lot of time in blue-collar jobs, so I see a lot of people who've really been suffering through a lot of those problems. And if you're making the policies about them, you know, those people are certainly working. I would be the last to say the people in those jobs are not working, but they have more of a cushion about what's going to really damage them.
James Reed, short story writer based in Omaha, Nebraska. Mr. Reed, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you. Nice talking to you.
Time now for a little Freakonomics Radio. It's that moment every couple of weeks where we talk to Stephen Dubner, the co-author of the books and the blog of the same name. It is The Hidden Side of Everything. Dubner, good to talk to you.
Hey, Kai. It's good to be talked to.
I'll be gentle. Don't worry about it.
So we are just recovering here from Hurricane Irene on the East Coast. And,
yes.
it got the attention of a lot of people who don't normally pay attention to hurricanes, let me tell you. And one thing that struck me is that when it comes to hurricanes, all we really know how to do, even after all these years, is deal with the symptoms. We don't actually have a way to treat the disease itself.
Well, so are you going to have like a hurricane vaccine? Is that where the hidden side of this conversation is going?
It's exactly where we're going. I talked to Nathan Myhrvold, who's the CEO of the invention firm Intellectual Ventures.
Uh-huh.
His company has a possible solution.
We've come up with a way of either reducing the strength of hurricanes or preventing them altogether. And it has the advantage that it's both cheap and entirely passive.
So as Myhrvold explains it, hurricanes form when the surface water in the ocean gets heated up during the summer and creates a lot of thermal energy. Meanwhile, there's tons of cool water that could displace all that thermal energy sitting just a couple hundred feet down.
Now, the way it works is you have to stir the ocean.
Right. So
what could possibly go wrong?
Exactly. Now, you could have some giant egg beaters on the bottom of military helicopters that probably won't work. But their idea is much simpler. It's called the Salter Sink, named for a scientist in Scotland named Stephen Salter. And it's really just a big float, a big floating ring or a series of these big floats that you drop into the ocean.
How does it work? Help me out here. I'm not conceptualizing.
All right. So picture like a kind of a big plastic jellyfish. You've got a floating ring, maybe 100 feet across, and it's got a big plastic sleeve attached to the ring that goes down into the water. Now, as waves crash over the top of this floating ring, that would push the warm surface water down the sleeve, which would churn the cold water up to the surface. So if you put a fleet of these things out in parts of the oceans where hurricanes do form, you could rob those hurricanes of their thermal energy.
Yeah, I'm going back to my previous statement, which is what could possibly go wrong with this? But also, I mean, come on, it's A, impractical, and B, it's got to be expensive.
It sounds very expensive until you compare it to the cost of dealing with hurricanes. Here's Myhrvold again.
Our rough estimates are it would take on the order of 10,000 of these devices, which ought to be possible to construct for a few thousand dollars apiece. Even if it was tens of millions of dollars per year, that is a drop in the bucket compared to what even one of these hurricanes, the property damage that it causes.
And that's property damage, Kai, of course, to say nothing of loss of life, which is very substantial.
Yeah, fair point. Let me just ask you, though. I mean, it can't be all upside, right?
Well, the first thought would be environmental concerns, but those actually appear pretty benign when you look it through. Myhrvold has actually identified a different kind of problem.
You could argue that one of the downsides is that it would allow people to keep building things near the seashore. Now, they seem to be doing that perfectly well without having any hurricane prevention. So I think the horse may be out of the barn in that particular case.
And that's what I'm saying. It's moral hazard, right? It's like the financial crisis all over again. Big banks bail out people building houses by the seashore.
There
all
you
that
go.
Good stuff.
The hurricane bailout. And, right. you know, now believe right. it or not, the biggest obstacle to trying this out, however, may be simply figuring out, you know, who's going to pay for it.
I have the answer to that one. Nathan Myhrvold was a Microsoft guy, right? He's a bajillionaire. No?
And he's got all those cookbook profits rolling in now, too.
That's right. Stephen Dubner, FreakonomicsRadio.com. We'll see you in a couple of weeks, man.
Thanks, Guy.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by Best Buy for Business, with commercial-grade inventory and personal account managers helping you get ready for business. BestBuyForBusiness.com.
Coming up, where we are 10 years after September 11th.
First of all, there is obviously a huge uncertainty about terrorism. Never before had there been anything on this scale. And the policy response was widely debated both in the U.S. and, of course, abroad.
But first, let's do the numbers. Stocks fell for the third straight trading day. European debt, the global economy, you know the drill. Take your pick. The Dow Industrial is down 100 points, 0.9%, settled at 11,139. NASDAQ off 6 points, about 0.25%, closed at 2473. The S&P 500 sputtered 8 points, 0.75%, finished at 1165. Financial stocks continued their role as investor punching bags. Morgan Stanley hemorrhaged nearly 4% today. J.P. Morgan Chase and Bank of America each shed roughly 3.5%. Citibank gave back almost 2.5%. Not all bad news, though. Shares of packaging company Temple Inland shot up 25%. That after International Paper agreed to buy the company, investors padded shares of International Paper more than 8%. Meantime, Sunoco shone more than 5% brighter after it announced plans to quit the volatile refining business and concentrate on the retail side of things. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.98%. I'm going to say that again, 1.98% on the 10-year. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at Marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at Marketplace.org/the Big Book.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Federal Reserve releases its latest Beige Book Summary of Commentary on Current Economic Conditions, also known as the Beige Book. NASA discusses new observations about solar flares that can impact communication and navigation systems. And musician Buddy Holly was born on September 7, 1936. He would have been 75. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. That's American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. This Sunday, as you know, is September 11th. It's the 10th since people started paying attention to that particular date.
I'm sorry. I'm going to interrupt you right now. We have a what appears to be a very serious... Is that the World Trade Tower?
The Capitol has been evacuated. Just about every federal building in the city.
Oh, my God! Oh, my God!
Not sure exactly what happened, but it was another explosion.
What the people on the scene don't seem to realize is that one of the twin towers has
collapsed.
One of the two towers is
gone. Both of the twin towers of the World Trade Center have collapsed. The second tower.
My name is Bill Thompson. I'm the chairperson of the Battery Park City Authority.
Battery Park's the neighborhood right around the World Trade Center. Lots of big businesses, thousands of residents. Bill Thompson was, for most of the past decade, the New York controller, the guy responsible for the city's finances. Look over your shoulder and tell me what you see over there.
I'm looking at growth. I'm looking at the new World Trade Center, which is going up. I mean, if you look across the street, this is Lower Manhattan coming back at its strongest.
What do you think of the new building?
It's gorgeous.
It's hard to draw a straight line from what happened 10 years ago on this spot to where we are in the economy today. People will tell you it can't be done, that adding up the lost lives and the destroyed property and the emotional impact just doesn't add up. And maybe that's true. But you can prove this. It's been a rough 10 years.
9/11 was really a watershed era.
Nick Bloom is an associate professor of economics at Stanford University. He studies, quite simply, uncertainty.
First of all, there is obviously a huge uncertainty about terrorism. Never before had there been anything on this scale. And the policy response was widely debated both in the US and, of course, abroad. I was actually living in the UK at the time, and it generated just globally tremendous uncertainty. And the world doesn't really seem to have recovered since then.
Bloom charts what he calls policy-related economic uncertainty. He literally charts it. You can see him on our website.
Throughout the 90s, uncertainty was pretty low in the US. Policy was relatively stable. You knew where you stood. You knew how things were going to progress until 9/11. And 9/11/2001 is a big spike. Stays high.
Because of Afghanistan and then Iraq, things steady for a bit around 2005, 2006, and then kind of go haywire.
That's the credit crunch, the Obama election, the euro crisis, all the way through to the midterms in 2010.
And straight on through to the debt limit fight this summer. Bloom's methodology was basic. Searches for the word uncertainty in news reports from the last 10 years and in the minutes from two decades worth of Fed meetings.
The Federal Reserve, so the committee chaired by Greenspan and more recently by Bernanke, often discuss economic uncertainty. And they discussed it very heavily around 9/11. You see their minutes are peppered with the statement, economic uncertainty, worried about uncertainty.
We're only a few blocks away from Wall Street and the New York Stock Exchange here.
For Bill Thompson that day, the uncertainty was about the very future of New York.
It still was. What's going to happen to New York City? And you knew you were going to be part of an effort to come back. But what were we going to do? The financial industry in New York, you know, there was a big concern. Would they stay here? Everything had been paralyzed. Everything was stopped.
We were afraid that the whole system would seize up. That's a term that Alan Greenspan used a lot back then. We were afraid that banks would simply stop trading with each other.
Bob McTeer was the head of the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas 10 years ago. That fear he was talking about helps explain why the Federal Reserve issued only one public statement on September 11th.
The Fed stands ready to lend to the banking system as needed, something along those lines.
So it did. It flooded the system with cash and cut interest rates a lot over the next couple of years.
Later on, of course, people said the Fed was too easy during this period and that it probably helped hype up the housing market too much. But they forget the conditions that existed back then. Chairman Greenspan was seriously worried about the possibility of deflation, and it looked like we might slip into a new recession, a double dip.
At the White House, the worry was terrorism, not recession.
It colored everything, of course.
Mitch Daniels is the governor of Indiana today. 10 years ago, he was the director of the Office of Management and Budget under George W. Bush.
There was a sense, perhaps inflated, of risk around work and I guess around the whole country there for a while. And then the whole question of what we now call homeland security and what it ought to be, how big it ought to be, how much it ought to cost, these were decisions that we're still living with today.
Ohio State political scientist John Mueller calls that the reaction cost.
Yes, it includes the Department of Homeland Security, the Department of Justice, the FBI, of course, and military spending within the country to protect bases. It includes a huge amount of police and intelligence costs within the United States. There's also state and local government spending. Then there's additional things such as waiting times in airports, which costs money. And even if you don't include things like the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, the cost of counterterrorism in the United States over the 10-year period accumulates to over $1 trillion.
Most would include the cost of the war in Afghanistan. A few might add Iraq, although reasonable people disagree about whether that war would have happened even without September 11th. Harvard professor Linda Bilmes co-wrote a book called The $3 Trillion War about the costs of Iraq.
My own sense is that one of the reasons that President Bush went to war in March 2003, one of the reasons is that he and his team and the country was very jittery. I think that after 9/11, he felt that the risk of what might happen if we didn't invade Iraq was bigger than if we did. And I suspect that if we had not been in that jittery environment, cooler heads would have prevailed.
Maybe, maybe not. But Bilmes says there is another thing to consider when you're talking about the economic legacy of September 11th.
The fact is that we have now spent trillions of dollars in Iraq and Afghanistan, all of which has been borrowed. Now, the consequences of that have been, of course, an enormous run-up in our national debt, which has been the subject of so much attention right now, and the fact that we owe interest that we are going to have to repay for those debts.
There's probably never going to be a way to calculate the true costs of September 11th. We talked to a lot of people for this story, economists, politicians, analysts, journalists, looking for that defining piece of tape about September 11th and its economic legacy. We finally got it from Brock Blomberg, an economist at Claremont McKenna College.
Our generation asks, what were you doing when the Twin Towers fell? And the same way that a generation ago, we ask, what were you doing when Kennedy was shot? So to me, I think that impact is so much greater than any economic impact. You know, how it affects our soul. And that's funny for an economist to use that word. But I think, to me, that's what I think of when I think September 11th.
Our coverage of the economic legacy of September 11th continues on the broadcast tomorrow and on Marketplace.org, where you can check out some of those charts from Stanford economist Nick Bloom about economic and political uncertainty over the past 20 years. They're kind of interesting.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out today, just to put things into some kind of September 11th perspective. This morning, the Secretary of Homeland Security, Janet Napolitano, said she can foresee a day when we'll be able to keep our shoes on going through airport security. She said better technology ought to help with that. Didn't say what the technology would be, though. Also said we shouldn't look to be rid of those 3-ounce bottles of liquid anytime soon. So that's not going to change. All right, that's Marketplace from APM, American Public Media, on this Tuesday. Today, the Dow dropped 100 points, about 0.9%. The NASDAQ off 6 points, 0.25%. The S&P 500 coughed up 8 points, about 0.75% there. Thanks to Ethan Lindsay and Jolie Podokas on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid and Doug Krisner. And that is where you can turn tomorrow morning for the latest of the breakdown, our coverage of our economy one step at a time. Coming up next time back on The Big Show, our Jobs-a-Palooza continues.
I'm 38. I'm a doctor, and the last time I worked as a doctor was 2 years ago.
When long-term unemployment becomes the norm. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM. That's American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.